On today's episode of Good Work, Chris Hines of the Minnesota Star Tribune joins me to discuss his new book on Anthony Edwards, Game 1 of the Western Conference Finals, the MVP, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and we preview the Eastern Conference Finals. All that and a little bit more coming up right now. Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. A bit of business before we get into today's show. We are, of course, on YouTube, so don't forget to rate, review, subscribe to us there, as well as all the places you consume your audio podcast. I am in scenic Oklahoma City. I am joined by my friend Chris Hines of the Minnesota Star Tribune. He's got a book out on Anthony Edwards that's coming out very, very soon. We're going to talk about that. Chris, how you doing, man?
I'm good. And a little behind the scenes magic for your listeners and viewers. We're in the same hotel, just floors right. apart from each other right now, as we just discovered. So the magic of podcasting in the same hotel.
The magic of Wi-Fi. Hopefully,
that's right. Hotel
the
Wi-Fi
upholds. Chris, I was a little surprised last night at how the game got out of hand. Really, really quickly. 114-88. Oklahoma City takes a 1-0 lead in the Western Conference Finals. It was a 4-point game at halftime. And Julius Randle was hitting every single catch and shoot shot of his life to the point where I'm like, oh, he's going into free agency this summer. He is declining that player option and getting all of his money. And then the second half happens where you just look up and you're like, Jay McDaniels, foul trouble. None of the Minnesota Timberwolves can shoot. Like, what was the thing that struck to you the most out of last night?
I think it was the ability of Oklahoma City to prevent the Wolves from really getting into the paint, whether it was first line drive defense, because that's what the Wolves like to do, break you down, get into the paint, and whether that's to score in the paint or to initiate ball movement, get open looks in rhythm threes. You know, I thought in the first half the Wolves were getting some of that. And like you said, Julius was doing a great job of just knocking stuff down that was available. Oklahoma City tilts their defense a little bit towards him, I think more in the second half. And the Wolves supporting cast was just flat out missing shots, whether it was open looks that were good looks, or I thought in the second half, a lot of their stuff was forced. I thought they were trying to make stuff happen. And you just kind of see an avalanche effect kind of happening of nobody's hitting shots. So I'm going to try to hit a shot and break us out of this. I'm going to try to do something. And that's when the Wolves are at their worst. And that's when the Thunder are capitalizing and at your best, when they kind of smell that weakness in you as an opponent.
Look, I thought not just the 4-point lead, but the style of play, right? Oklahoma City likes to turn you over. It's very clear and very evident that Minnesota has said, I've heard Chris Finch say it almost to some degree, their set offense isn't that great. If we can play against a set defense against them, we have a really good chance, because they've got one score and a bunch of guys who are wild cards. But the second you start getting the turnovers, they start coming fast and quick. And I think the strategy became, if we drive it into the lane, we're going to get it stripped. So how about we just out here and launch threes? And I think those two things were correlated, the turnovers and the 51 three-point shots. Well, I think like 60% of their shots came from three. And I just didn't like most of the looks, even though they were open.
Yeah, that shot diet, it was stark. Like, I think I saw somewhere that was like a record for a Western Conference Finals game, the number of threes that they were hoisting. You know, I know that's the game plan. That's how they're probably going to have to beat the Thunder, is by shooting well. But you know, to your point about the supporting cast, the Thunder supporting cast showed up in the second half last night. You know, J-Dub got going a little bit. I remember Kenrich Williams even having a couple buckets in a key stretch. And it's like, you know, at the same time, Naz Reid was like 1-for-8 or 1-for-9. He finished 1-for-11. Dante DiVincenzo was struggling to get going. Nikhil Alexander-Walker, like, if the Wolves are going to win this series, they need that bench, that depth that they like to brag about and talk about having eight starters. They need to show up in the Western Conference Finals. You're not going to win. They were able to kind of win those two series against the Lakers and Warriors with kind of fluctuating performances from their supporting cast. That's not going to be the case this time around. If they're going to win, they need that supporting cast to produce because of all the attention that Ant is going to get, that Randall is also going to get at various times. And, you know, Jaden McDaniels, I thought one of the sneaky things that went haywire for the Wolves last night was his foul trouble, because Jaden has been great at both ends of the floor for them this postseason, not just the defensive end. And I thought not having his offense was, especially on a night when everybody else was struggling, was just as impactful of a loss as his defense was.
Chris, the second he picked up that fourth foul early in third quarter, it was almost like nothing went right after that. And what happens with a guy like that is, I said it in my last podcast, and I was saying it from a romantic point of view, so to speak. I want Ant to guard Shea. I want Shea to guard Ant. Like, that's the basketball we kind of grew up watching. But when you have all world defenders, Lou Dort, Jalen Williams, Jaden McDaniels, of course you're going to have those guys guard the main guys. But Jaden McDaniels is the guy to me that is, how do I put this? Like the Kawhi, the young Kawhi Leonard type of player for them, where, oh yeah, Ant is the guy, Julius Randle has emerged in his space. But Jaden McDaniels is like this glue, this underutilized sort of commodity that, if they are to win this series, he's going to be the guy that everybody's like, man, I didn't realize how good, how great he was, especially on defense. I think you found out, Chris, how much they need him in this series, because it went haywire the second that he exited the game.
100%. And some of that was, I think, the team's also just frustration with the whistle that Shea was getting.
Yeah.
After the game, they said all the right things, but you could clearly see just in the way that they were reacting to every call, just how much that was frustrating them last night, and specifically with Jaden. I thought the moment of the game, kind of the play that summed everything up, was the sixth foul that Jaden got late, when I think Shea, he falls over, gets the three-point play, the bucket goes, Jaden gets called for the foul. And I'm kind of looking at the replays, Jaden really didn't make much contact with him, if we're being honest here, and it was just Shea falling over. And you could just see him as he stormed off the court, just the frustration that was setting in. And that was the second half to a T right there.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, the Wolves were cognizant of this coming in. It's something they're going to have to watch. It's something they're going to have to manage. I think there was a similar vibe entering the Lakers series about the whistle that LeBron and Luka were going to get, and so they were mentally preparing themselves for that. They have to go back to that before that they had in that Lakers series, because they did handle that well, and they did kind of get through that series without losing their composure when it came to the officiating. Last night was a return to kind of the Wolves I've seen from time to time, where they let the officiating get the best of them. As dubious as some of the calls may have been, you just can't afford to let that affect your composure in the Western Conference Finals. And Jaden specifically, he's a player that runs very hot. He plays with a lot of emotion. He's done a very good job this year, I think, of controlling things. He doesn't commit as many frustration fouls. He keeps his emotions in check much better than he ever has at any point in his career. But last night, I think, if anything, it served as a reminder and a wake-up call for the Wolves to get their minds in the right place, because if they just want to complain about the officiating the whole time, they will, but they'll end up losing the series at the same time.
That's the thing that jumped out to me. One of the things that jumped out to me last night was how on edge Minnesota was about the officiating. In the as early as like the first 3 or 4 minutes, like you saw Mike Conley, who's the most mild-mannered, never getting a tech guy, frustrated that they didn't get a timeout in. Like, Julius Randle always runs hot. and is always barking at the refs. He was so frustrated with Shea, threw the ball at him, got a technical foul called. Like, you can tell that it's a point of emphasis for them, that they've watched a lot of film. They haven't played, for people who don't know. They haven't played since February 28th, I believe. And right. Julius Randle did not play in that game. I don't think he played in three of their four matchups. So this is a kind of a filling out process. But it just felt like they were so focused on, man, Shea gonna trip and fall the second that he feels any level of contact, while we're getting mauled on the other end of the floor. To some degree, I understand the frustration, but like you said, you gotta be able to play through it. You gotta know where you are and where Oklahoma City has sort of created a reputation in a positive way for how they can play with the officiating.
Yeah, that's the everything you said, by the way, that happened in the first quarter. That was like the first 6 minutes of the game. It just set the tone. It was crazy to see, because it went from like 0 to 100 right away.
Real quick.
When it came to there, real quick. And I think Shea had like 7 free throws in the first 6 minutes of the game. And you just saw it was right then and there. And the second quarter, you know, I think it flipped a little bit where they weren't calling a lot of stuff. Shea was like, what was it, 2 for 13 at the half?
Yep.
And
yep.
He was getting frustrated with the officiating. But then I just think in the second half, like, he started getting the calls. The Wolves were just a step slow on defense. So when you're a step slow against Shea, that's when he's gonna make you pay. And he is going to be able to draw that contact a little easier. The Wolves were playing better defense in the second quarter. And so I think they were in better position and therefore getting the benefit of the whistle for that 12 minutes. So if you're them today, you go back to that film and say, look, this second quarter is the blueprint for how we should guard him and the team moving forward. You just got to put it together for 48 minutes. But yeah, that first quarter really, really set the tone. And I wonder how much of that was intentional on Ant's part to maybe, you know, set the tone a little bit with that. You remember,
was
in the
he
Lakers
trying to get into Shea's
pushed,
head a little bit?
Maybe a little bit, right? Remember when he in the Lakers series he was pushing LeBron and he got a foul called after like pushing him for like 10 seconds in a row? He did that a little bit with Shea last night too. I think it was like at the end of the first half.
Yeah.
Like there
yep.
was that moment where they got like tangled up and Ant was just like shoving him, and finally the official called a foul, which he probably could have called at any point during that sequence.
Yeah.
But I noticed a little bit of that last night on Ant's part, just to maybe try to set that tone of, you know, listen, we're gonna push you around. In some ways we don't care what the officials call. We're gonna be physical with you up and down the floor.
It was funny. It was like, I think it was the end of the first half. It was one of those inbound passes in front of Oklahoma City's bench. Shea and Ant get tangled up. Shea goes to the floor. Ant just kind of not quite stands over him, but it was kind of like a wrestler in a way, you know, after dropping a rock bottom or something like that on somewhere. That's like 20 years old, but you know, that's as far as I'm going for y'all. All right.
I get the reference.
He drops a wrestling move, like stands over on him, Chris, pushes him again. And then finally the ref is like, okay, Ant. I let you get away with 2. I let you get away with 3. You can't do this in front of me. But I feel like you said Ant was doing that intentionally and was willing to take a foul to kind of set some level of tone there.
And it was funny. Ant was complaining to the official after the play, and I could see like the ref was like kind of animated in his description to Ant, like essentially, like, what do you want me to do here? Like, you were pushing him like for 5 straight seconds. Like, I got to call something, right? And Ant, I think, was trying to make the case that Shea fouled him first or whatever like that. But you know, the Wolves have had a complicated relationship with the officiating. This is nothing new for them. They are a team that does complain a lot. They generally, I don't think, feel like they get a fair whistle overall. You know, Ant has had his moments, obviously, with the number of technical fouls he had this season. That's obviously gone down of late in the playoffs. But, you know, overall, I think and listen, you can't have it both ways. Like, you know, if you want the refs to allow physicality on one end of the floor, then you got to be willing to put up with it at the other end of the floor in the way that Oklahoma City plays defense. So how do you want the series to be called? Do you want it to be called a little more closer and by the book, or do you want the physicality to be allowed? Because if that's the case, then the Thunder are going to push you around pretty well too. Yep. So which way do you want it to be?
That mm-hmm. Jalen Williams and Lou Dort, and you know, Shea's little on the skinny side, but the rest of those dudes are. I know Chet is skinny, but Isaiah Hartenstein is a mountain of a man. Like, you've got a bunch of dudes there that probably have no problem playing you in a physical style. Now, as we spin it forward to game two on Thursday, I don't know if I see a drastic turnaround other than, oh, we're going to keep shooting these shots and we're going to make these shots. I think they have to find a way to get A and out on the open floor, maybe force some turnovers. That's where the physicality can help you. But I think they got to get Ant the ball in different places, and he just can't be staring at a wall of defenders at the top of the key. You're playing right into their hands.
Yeah, and I think we heard a little bit of what their solution may be when Ant was saying playing a little more off the ball. He did that, I think, effectively, especially in games 3 and 4 of the Warriors series.
Yeah,
and that's how he got going in that, and that's how they basically won that series, was Ant, kind of Julius having the ball in his hands, Ant operating off the ball, having different guys break down the defense and make plays out of that. That's obviously where Julius had such a big imprint, and the chemistry between them was evident in that series. Going to be a little tougher this time around with the size and OKC's ability to pack the paint. Golden State couldn't do that as effectively with their lack of size.
Right.
And just having, I think just having, you know, Mike Conley probe the defense, having, you know, even Jaden taking people off the dribble from time to time, like having other guys kind of get into the teeth of that defense to have it shift around a little bit, and then having Ant be the guy that's getting the swing pass.
Right.
Instead of initiating the swing pass. That might be one of the adjustments the Wolves make coming into game two. And, you know, we'll see if the Thunder anticipate it, if they have a response to it. But also at the end of the day, like in that first half, I was sitting there thinking, you know, the Wolves were up by 8 or 9 in the first half, and they did have a number of good looks. And I'm sitting there thinking, man, if they hit 2 or 3 of these, this is a whole different game.
Right.
They're up 15, 18. They had moments in that first half where if Dante or Nikhil had hit a couple of shots, that game could have been, you know, double digits,
drastically
even close to 20, you know, at some points. That's what they have to hang their hats on going into game two.
Look, it's important for me to say this. Last series, Naz Reid, Nikhil Alexander-Walker, I think Naz Reid shot 46 from 3. Nikhil Alexander-Walker shot 45 from 3. Dante hasn't shot well the entire playoffs. He's hit big shots. He just, maybe timely shots. He just hasn't been consistent mm-hmm. on shooting. Last night, those three guys, 5 for 28. Yep. You're not winning a damn thing playing like that. You're not beating Golden State if you're shooting like that, let alone the team with that won 68 games. So with that said, Chris, you have a book coming out called Ant. You were telling me about it like this time last year.
I just so happen to have a copy of it right here.
Look at that. He is ready.
I gotta do some self-promoting. It's not in my bones to be a self-promoter, but I got to for this. So there's copies of it available for pre-orders everywhere out June 3rd. Yes.
Hey, I like it. See, if the Minnesota Timberwolves were actually going to make the NBA Finals, that would actually boost this thing into orbit. But if last night was any indication, it might be a short series. But with that said,
yes,
I read the first couple of chapters of it, and it struck to me, Chris, hey, I'm like, oh, he did a lot of Atlanta-ing during this whole thing.
I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you. Yes.
You were deep in Atlanta. And there are certain, and I'm not comparing Ant to a movie per se, but there are certain movies that I watch, and I'm like, the city is a character in the movie. Like, I watched Do the Right Thing, and like the weather is a character because it's so hot, and clearly it's Brooklyn is right. So hot. How much is Atlanta, just the city of Atlanta, a character in Anthony Edwards' life?
It's always there. You know, even in Minnesota, The Atlanta never leaves him, right? Atlanta never leaves him. And I'm glad you felt that in the book, because that was one of the things I really wanted to get across, especially in the first half of the book. I spent 6 weeks down there last summer. I got an Airbnb And I just posted up in Atlanta for about 5-6 weeks. And one of the guys in the book who's quoted extensively, Dana Watkins, who was one of Ant's early AAU coaches.
Yep.
He was essentially my guide to Ant's early life in Atlanta. And he was introducing me to a lot of the people that you meet in the book. And, you know, and it's not just where Ant grew up, it's all parts of Atlanta too. Like Ant had, you know, Ant went to high school in Buckhead and he was spending a lot of time in the suburbs with, you know, families of his AU teammates and football teammates. So Ant was all over Atlanta. He experienced all parts of Atlanta when he was growing up. And, you know, I think later in the book, AJ Moye, the former Indiana basketball player who plays a big role in chapter 6 of the book, he kind of summed it up and he said, listen, we all see Ant and we see Atlanta. Like, you know, he's like, I'm 42 years old and I still wear my hat a certain way and I still dress a certain way and I'm college educated, this and that, but like, I'm still Atlanta and that's Ant and that's what we love about Ant, right? So it's always just, it's just a part of him. And it's in his demeanor, it's in his confidence, it's in his sense of humor, all of it. And, you know, I think even though he's in Minnesota, you know, that definitely has never left him. And yeah, that first half of the book, you know, it's Atlanta. It's all Atlanta, basically, for 5.5 chapters.
Yeah, when I think of sport or even culture, you're thinking about Anthony. Before you even get to Anthony Edwards, you're thinking about like Cam Newton and Usher and guys like that. He is the most Atlanta. My friend Bo Money Jones, a friend of the show, says this all the time. He says, Ant is the most Atlanta dude he's ever met and he's never been around in his life. Like, he's just, it drips off of him, like you see it. But it's not like, it's not this thing, Chris, where you see players in other cities wear New York hats or LA hats and they're kind of sending that as this like subtle thing of, yeah, I can't wait to get back there. He seems very secure in his skin, secure with where he is leading this franchise. It's just that he's just an Atlanta dude and it's not like a threat. I don't feel like anybody's threatened by the fact that he's so Atlanta. And I think that, you know, maybe the organization, I wonder how the organization feels about the fact that he's so very, these are two totally different places, Minnesota, Minneapolis, and Atlanta, but it seems to work.
It does. And I actually think, like, at that point in his life, I didn't really touch on this too much in the book, but I think at that point in his life, at like 19 years old, getting drafted by Minnesota and having to move out of Atlanta. And I think at that point in time, there were a lot of people that were trying to get their hooks in Ant. And I think one of the best things that actually happened to him was getting drafted by Minnesota, a place that's kind of far away. You're having to move away from home for the first time. But it's a place that, and especially in the winter, that not a lot of these people are going to want to visit.
You know? That's a great point.
So I think that actually was a blessing in disguise in some ways, just for his development early in his NBA career. And he's always kept a tight-knit small circle. He's always had a good sense of that, of not inviting too many people in. And so when it was just him and his core group in Minneapolis for the first few years of his career, I think that really helped him just get his NBA career, focus on basketball, focus on your development. And I think that really helped launch him the first couple of years of his career. And listen, I think, you know, Ant is genuine. And that's one of the things that people are drawn to about him. It's one of the things people like about him, the authenticity. Like, you don't want him to not be Atlanta, you know, like that's what you love his personality, you love his positivity, his humor. It's what infects the organization in a positive way. Like, it's how he leads, that energy and enthusiasm. And like, you don't want him to change, because who he is, you know, a natural kind of leader in that sense. And so, you know, they want him to be his authentic self, and he is comfortable in that way with this organization and vice versa.
It's funny that you mention Ant as leader, right? Because some people look at some of the other things and like, man, there's no way he could be a leader. But you put him around a lot of people, let's be honest, nobody would think that Rudy Gobert, Karl Towns, Julius Randle would be players that someone like Ant would pour into and try to empower. But for whatever reason, he finds ways to have connect with all of these guys at a very, very young age. And I was thinking about it when I was reading, you know, the early chapters, the effects that his football coaches had on him, how disciplined they were with him, how, you know, they should almost say tough love, but it was a hard love, but it was a love there. I wonder how much of that sort of influences how he moves with his teammates and tries to find ways to connect with them and empower them.
It's like you said, it's always been who he is and a part of who he is. And Finch kind of, in a way, is, I say, like part of the lineage of coaches that he's had. Like when you read about those early football coaches and then you hear stories about how Finch is hard on him in film sessions, it has faced a lot worse in his lifetime than Chris Finch yelling at him in a film session. So he can take that, you know, without much of an issue, right? But he's always been a positive teammate. To your point about Rudy and Carl, you know, he would go over their houses for dinners, have one-on-one conversations with each of them. You know, there's a section later in the book that I call Fire Potatoes, where Rudy talks about the potatoes that, like, his chef cooks up just for Aunt when Aunt comes over for dinner, because Aunt said they're fire potatoes, are the best potatoes I've ever had in my life. So, you know, they find a way to bond over stuff like that. And with Carl said Aunt and, you know, his best friend Nick were always over the house. Aunt would come over and it would just be, you know, Aunt and Carl chatting about the team, chatting about basketball, you know, maybe off in a room playing pool together somewhere. Carl even said there were times where I was there with Jordan and him and Nick are just in another room playing pool together or something like that. Like, so he always has been the ultimate, like, teammate, the ultimate positive teammate, trying to bring everybody together. There's no hierarchy with him. Like, everybody is equal in his eyes, no matter who you are, no matter what your contract status is. Kyle Anderson also has a quote in the book saying that, you know, two of the best teammates he's ever been around are Ant and Ja Morant, because they like to have guys be included in that way. That's how he leads. That's how he's led for most of his career. He hasn't been the rah-rah kind of vocal leader. And that's starting to emerge a little bit last season and this one. But the energy, the positivity, the empowerment of his teammates, and the way that he just approaches every day, that has been how he has led, whether he realizes it or not.
Yeah, I don't think it's something that he's necessarily, like, super intentional about. I just think that's just naturally who he is. I don't think he looks at Julius Randle and says, man, this dude is so dour, I got to be extra on him. I just think it's naturally, like you said, he seems like someone that's naturally warm. That's probably the way that I would put it. He feels more naturally warm in ways that you don't usually expect out of 23-year-old, like, superstars. Not that players are traditionally cold, but there's a warmth and an authenticity to him. And that brings to this last thing that I wanted to ask about with the book. I wonder, because he's had so much loss, you know, cancer going through his family and everything else, and cancer hitting, you notice, like, cancer hitting people in their, you know, 50s and 60s, which is still really young when we think about it. I wonder how much the losses have affected him. He was really close with his mother out of her four kids. You said, like, Aunt was the one that she kind of doted on. He was the baby and everything else. I wonder how much loss has sort of driven him, maybe even subconsciously, and affected how he deals with teammates and people just in general.
I don't know if it's subconsciously or consciously, but I think it definitely has. And, you know, as people around him said, you know, listen, that happened to him when he was 13, right? It's a lot for people to take in when you're 13 years old. And it affects you in ways that you don't realize or maybe even process until later in life. But the thing that it did for him was it gave him the work ethic that he eventually needed to get to the NBA. That's what everybody around him said. It's like, after that happened, you know, it was just kind of a point A to point B kind of thing. He processed it by being in the gym, by always being around, you know, coaches and his teammates and always working, you know. And, you know, one of his people told me, like, I don't know if Ant's ever been to therapy. I don't know if he, you know, how he's dealt with it or whatever. But that was how he dealt with it as a teenager. And I don't know. I don't know if that affects his positive outlook, because I think he's always been that way. And his mother and his grandmother were very positive, uplifting people, and mm-hmm. always his biggest cheerleaders, his teammates' biggest cheerleaders too, which I think is important to note as well. And I think that's where Ant gets that quality from. But I think the work ethic and the drive is what came after that. The positivity, the jovial nature, the optimistic outlook of life, I think, was always there, and that never dimmed after his mother and his grandmother pass. But I do think it affected him in just his determination to make it, whether for them, for himself, for his family. But that wasn't always present beforehand, and then it was afterwards.
Yeah, I would love to go inside, like, to psychoanalyze, just because there seems like there's so much there. And I think he's one of the more, I only say complex, that's not even really the right word. I think he's one of the more layered superstars that the NBA has had come into the league in some time, because he doesn't follow sort of this traditional basketball machine model that so many of today's players come in. He's not a basketball lineage guy. He's not basketball has been bred in me since I was 5 years old and everybody could see it. He was a football player who played basketball. And then he became a basketball player who played football, and then he had to give football up. So he seems like such a layered individual in like a positive, fascinating way. And last thing with this one, Chris, what was Ant's response when you told him that you were writing a book on him? I would love to know his initial. Sure. What?
Yeah. So I will say he before he and I ever had a word about it, I'm sure he found out about it because I had told Justin Holland, his longtime coach, business manager, always at the games. So I had told Justin that this opportunity came about. And so he and I had talked about it a couple times before Ant and I ever talked about it. But the first time I actually talked to Ant about it, it was in Las Vegas last year during Team USA practices. I think you might have been out there. I'm not 100% sure. But Ant met with us. Every Team USA player kind of met with the media in a separate session. And it was after that I went out in the hallway and I, you know, Nick was there, Justin was there, and Ant, they were all kind of hanging outside the hotel ballroom. And that was when I told Ant, I said, Ant, you know what I'm up to this summer, right? and he's like, yeah, I heard about that. And he was basically like, in a very Ant way, he's like, go get it was his word. And I told him how I was moving down to Atlanta for a month. That was my plan. And, you know, Dana was going to help me out and this and that. And initially, like, he was going to participate, but then we got into the course of the season and it just kind of, he was tired, busy, everything. He's like, well, and Justin told me, like, he's like, well, you talk to everybody anyway. So he's like, it doesn't feel like he needs to say anything. And I'm like, all right. But, you know, like I said, I've covered him for 5 years now. I've got quotes upon quotes to draw from. And that comes out in the book, obviously. But yeah, his initial word was go get it. That was literally what he told me. So, you know, it was cool that he had that attitude about it for sure.
Yeah, because a lot of guys, for those who don't know, and I've never written a book, like, I don't know if I have the attention span for it, but a lot of guys, when they find out that you're writing a book on them, they will go into obstruction, you know, strategy.
Yes.
Don't talk to him, whatever it is, you know what I mean, that sort of thing, because they don't want certain things aired or certain things said. It doesn't sound like he was like, hey, go ahead and do it. You stay in 5 weeks in Atlanta, I got a list of restaurants for you, and some of them might be adult establishments.
Exactly. But you know, I think it helped that, you know, obviously I've covered him. I'm not somebody that was just parachuting in, you know.
Right.
I think that helped. And I did, you know, 3 years ago, I did this story for the Star Tribune that was like a mini version of the book. Like, it was like a 3,500 word story. I went to Atlanta for like 3-4 days. I talked to some of the people that you'll meet in the book. And so through that, story, I had already developed relationships mm-hmm. with people around him, and everybody seemed to like how that story turned out. So when I came back to everybody and said, I'm doing a book, so we're just going to take that story I did 3 years ago and we're just going to blow it out a little bit. Everybody was seemingly on board with that. And so, you know, I think that helped kind of lay the groundwork for everybody being on board, and nobody turned down an interview request or didn't want to talk or, you know, and I think that's what helped put this all together.
That's really, really incredible, Chris. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Eastern Conference Final and a little MVP talk. You're listening to The Good Word here on Yahoo Sports. Welcome back to The Good Word here with Chris Hine. Chris, looking over at the Eastern Conference, that series starts tonight. Both teams have been on a long break, Knicks, Pacers. We won't have to get too much into it just because the game one is tonight. We got a big announcement coming up. By the time you guys hear, you guys will probably know already what I mean by big announcement. But do you see that series being more competitive, compelling, whatever that word is? Because most people, I think, view the Knicks as, oh, they're going to the NBA Finals, even though they've never been as long as any of us have been alive, right? Or do we look at the Indiana Pacers as, oh, this is a team that has played really good basketball from December on both ends of the floor, and we haven't paid enough attention to them?
I think the latter. I think the Knicks are in for a series here. I love the way the Pacers are playing right now. And as fun and as great as the content was coming out of Madison Square Garden, post-game of Game 6 in the Celtics series, I had the thought, having covered the Wolves last year and seeing mm-hmm, how they mm-hmm. treated the aftermath of that Denver series, like that in itself was a huge, momentous victory. I'm just a little wary of the Knicks maybe being a little emotionally spent after that Celtics series. And the Pacers were in the conference finals a year ago. They've been here, they've been through it. And I get a very businesslike vibe coming from them. So I think the approach in the series is going to be very different. I'll be very interested to see where the Knicks are at, just physically and emotionally, coming off of a very intense moment for the franchise. But on the same token, does that emotion just carry them through? I don't know. How do you channel it? How do you process that? But I think the one thing, the Pacers are relentless. And they will just not stop attacking you. And if as a basketball fan, I'm fascinated to check out this series. I think it's going to be a great one.
It's funny. I was looking at the scene, and I'm sure Dakota will probably pull up some photos from Getty or something like that to show. These fools hanging off the signs of 33rd and 6th, the 33rd and 7th, whatever the hell
exactly.
It was. Like, there's no way, and even though the players aren't out there, but there's this palpable emotion that comes from that. And it brought me back to Minnesota Denver last year, where there was so much intertwined, right? Minnesota was built to beat the Denver Nuggets in the same way that the New York Knicks were built to beat the Boston Celtics, where they got OG Anunoby the year before. And then they went and spent all those draft picks on Mikal Bridges, like someone spent a whole bunch of draft picks on Rudy Gobert, like that sort of synergy. And then once you beat them in the second round, and an emotional, different sort of emotion of Game 7, the 20-point comeback from Minnesota last year. This was just a dog walking. This year, for New York and Boston, I'm wondering, have you accomplished a goal? Do you have enough in your emotional reservoir, sort of like you just said, Chris, to be able to reach that same height? Now, yeah, Indiana beat you last year, but you felt like Indiana beat you because you got hurt, not because Indiana was this better team and you got to go and beat them. They just happen to be the team to beat you. And I wonder if they're going to be ready. And also, Tyrese Halliburton should have been maybe a lot higher on a lot of our clutch ballots this year. He was 11 of 12 in late game situations. He hit the game winner against Cleveland in game 2. They don't scare either. I think they're built, Chris, to be an NBA Finals team. We just didn't see it.
No, absolutely not. I think that overrated tag has lit a fire in Tyrese, for the duration of the playoffs. And look at that winning game two against Cleveland when, logical reasoning, they should have lost that game and they somehow end up pulling that out with the free throw miss and all of it, and Tyrese hitting that shot. I will say on the other end, I think Jalen Brunson is also made of kind of nerves of steel in that way.
If
there's a way for New York to navigate this series emotionally, it's going to be following his lead and taking the tone from him in the same way that Indiana takes their tone from Halliburton. I'm fascinated by the basketballness of it as somebody that's followed Carl for the duration of his career. What kind of a series is this for Carl? That feels to me like where this series is going to hinge and fluctuate back and forth a little bit is how does Carl perform in this series? What kind of matchups does Indiana have to throw at him? And I think Indiana's well equipped to defend him Pascal. And I feel like they've got the ability to defend him decently well and frustrate him a little bit. But at the same time, I think one of the reasons why Carl is flourishing with the Knicks this year is he doesn't have the pressure of being a one or even a 1B. He's the clear number two to Jalen Brunson, and that has allowed him to thrive. It's taken some of the pressure off of him to kind of bear the weight of a franchise on his shoulders, and I think that's one reason why he's played so well this season in New York. So I listen, prediction wise, whatever, I don't know where the series is going to go. I tend to like Indiana and just how consistent they've been. Yep. But if the Knicks won the series, certainly wouldn't surprise me either.
Look, it's funny. I was going to go to the Carl conversation because you know Carl as well as anyone. And I think if this series is going to have an X factor, it's not necessarily Halliburton and Brunson. It's going to be, I think, Miles Turner and Carl Towns. Because Miles Turner is the big man that you want big men to be today. You want someone to be able to score inside and out, defend at all three levels, shoot the three, defend the pick and roll, play the pick and roll. While Carl Towns is an amazingly gifted offensive player playing in New York City. Are you surprised that Carl has not been swallowed up by the pressure of playing in New York City?
Not really. I think Carl, because he's so skilled and that skill is just going to show out, especially over the course of the regular season. And I think he's in a better place in his career now. He's a little older, he's in his late 20s now. He's not 21, 22 years old at this point.
Right.
I think if that had happened maybe earlier in his career, maybe then you worry a little bit about the lights and the attention being a little too much. But I think, and especially having gone through a deep playoff run last year and, playing well in some big moments like game seven against Denver, that's added to his experience and just he's in a better place in his career to handle that now than he might have been 6 years ago. I'll say that. What's funny is this matchup between him and Miles Turner, before the Wolves got Gobert, there were always kind of rumblings that the Wolves were looking to get Miles Turner as that other piece alongside Carl, to be the five and Carl could drop down to the four. So there were always for a few years, whenever Miles Turner's name would pop up in trade conversations, the Wolves were always kind of a part of that. There was always some interest there to see if Miles Turner could end up to Minnesota. So, two guys who could have ended up playing in Minnesota together are going to be squaring off in the Eastern Conference Finals now.
I it is the prediction business, so I have to give one. I would much rather, for personal and professional reasons, spend games 3 and 4 of the NBA Finals in New York City. I just don't think we're going to be spending games 3 and 4 and possibly 6 of the NBA Finals in New York City because we're going to be in nap time.
I mean, I'm obligated to say you might be spending games 1 and 2 in New York City. I mean, the Western Conference Finals ain't over yet,
That's a good point.
Could be. I've got a Marriott booked for games 1 and 2, just in case, you know.
It's a weird thing. I know people get so wrapped up in, if it's an Indiana OKC final, nobody's going to watch. And I'm like, guys, the basketball itself, whatever it is as far as the ratings and all that stuff, hey, I don't have a Nielsen box. I don't know a black person with a Nielsen box. Maybe that's a discussion for another day, right? But for purposes of how these things go, I want to see good, compelling basketball with good storylines and good, like, the meat on the bone, so to speak, that we as media can tell these great stories and watch compelling basketball. I'm not worried about, like, theoretically, really worried about, man, I'd rather be in New York City than everywhere else. No, I'd rather not. I want to see great basketball. And if it's Oklahoma City, Indiana, so be it. I have a feeling that's my prediction. I don't know if it's going to happen, but that's my prediction. My prediction is that the Indiana Pacers win their series in 6 games, kind of in large part because I wonder what New York has for them strategically. Indiana stretches you out. They legit, they stretch you out offensively. Yes. They play a lot of pick and roll. But the thing is, it's not just Tyrese Halliburton. It's not Tyrese staring down the barrel of a defense. They got a bunch of guys who can play. Pascal Siakam, that dude is like legit a max player. We just don't think of him being that because after the championship in Toronto, he didn't, you know what I mean? Like, there's players who get sort of lost in our NBA conversation. I felt like he got lost and now he's, oh, we forgot how good, how great Pascal Siakam is. So yeah, I think the Pacers are winning that series in 6 in New York. If y'all win, I'll be happy. Don't be throwing nothing at me because I fight back. I'll tell y'all that now.
I'll add too. I really like Aaron Nesmith and the way that he kind of fits into the overall fabric. I think he's one of the most underrated players of this playoffs.
Like, absolutely.
Yeah, you know, I think he's a huge part of what Indiana does. You know, just because if Carl hears this and he might get mad at me, I'll say Knicks in 7. So I'll go Knicks in 7.
That's funny. It's funny. The two breakout players, the two like breakout role-ish players in the playoffs so far this year, Jay McDaniels, Aaron Nesmith. Someone sent me a text last night with a picture of Scottie Pippen saying, like, that's Jay McDaniels' ceiling. I said, aim higher. And then they sent me a picture of Kawhi Leonard. I said, there we go. That's where we're trying to go.
You fit right in with the Timberwolves social media community, Vinny. You should come on over because that's the kind of stuff they're talking about.
I've been on everybody's Summer Jam screen. I was on the Celtics screen last year when I said, hey, the Celtics are probably going to lose to Dallas in the finals or whatever it was, and they put me on their montage of people who were wrong. So I'm not going to say too much to be wrong, but I'm sure I've said enough that I'll actually be wrong. But when we come back, one final segment, we're going to talk about the MVP. Who might that be? Time for the last word here with Chris Hine. Chris, the MVP the MVP will be announced this afternoon. I'm sure nobody will be surprised when they hear Shai Gilgeous-Alexander of the Oklahoma City Thunder. I don't know if you saw this last night. Michael Malone was on SportsCenter in the postgame because he's done pregame and halftime and all that stuff with the countdown crew. And he talked about Shai Gilgeous-Alexander being like, and that's why he's the MVP. If I remember correctly, I'm old enough to remember when Michael Malone told us that we were all doubting dolts if we did not vote for Nikola Jokic as MVP. And now that he's no longer coaching Nikola Jokic, that's why Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is the MVP. You know what that sounds like to me, Chris Hine? You've seen A Few Good Men.
Yes.
Colonel Jessup is on the stand. Did you order the Code Red? Jack Nicholson finally loses it. You goddamn right I did. Now, I'm not saying that Nikola Jokic ordered the Code Red. I'm saying that Michael Malone believes that Nikola Jokic didn't stop the Code Red.
Didn't stop the Code Red from happening. Yes. Yeah, there you go. Yep.
That's why Michael Malone.
He got wind of the Code Red happening and was just like, I'm just going to go over here and not bother things. I did not see that. So you're bringing this to my attention for the first time.
It was
time.
Hilarious.
That's fascinating. I don't know how I would have voted.
It's not surprising that Shay's going to win this, right?
No, it's not. No, not at all. I feel like that's where, I think after Oklahoma City's start was for real, I think, ESPN would do all those straw polls and you'd always see Shay like that. That's when it flipped, right? Maybe like the first third of the season or whatever. Shay was at top and it just never, despite the numbers Jokic was putting up, and man, where there's some performances in there from Jokic where in other years, if Jokic hadn't already won three MVPs, it's like this would have flipped. But I think voter fatigue, narratives, the whole thing drives this in such a big way that it was never coming down off of Shay, especially as long as the Thunder were as dominant as they were. That matters to voters in this race. I don't have a vote anymore. I stopped. I did it 1 year and I stopped doing it after 1 year because I didn't like the conflict of interests that ends up happening with the all NBA stuff and guys' contracts. I'm like, this makes me feel
a little squeamish.
Yeah. So I stopped after 1 year. I don't know how I would have voted this year. I probably would have gone Shay for those same reasons. Best guy, great numbers on the number one team in the Western Conference, best team in the league. Traditionally that equals MVP. So
right.
Not a surprise at all.
No, I think the conversation, luckily the conversation wasn't as toxic as it was 2 or 3 years ago when Embiid won it. That made me feel.
That was weird. Yeah.
It was weird. It was uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I'm glad this was just regular old debate, right? Like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander being the best player on the team that wins 68 games. The one time, to my recollection, that a team won that many games and hit the best player to not win MVP was 1997 when Michael Jordan did not win because someone wrote a very sympathetic article about Karl Malone never winning MVP in Sports Illustrated. I don't remember the person's name, but it was Jackie McMullen. That part of it, right? Karl Malone wins the MVP and then gets walked down in the finals.
Yeah,
I think in 2017, the Warriors won 67 games, but that was the first year of Steph and KD. Neither one of them was going to win it that year because of how people felt about those two joining together. My personal sort of thing, Chris, is you got to be on the team that wins 50 games. Like that was the year that Russell Westbrook didn't win MVP. They won 47. I didn't vote for him. Like, how can you be most valuable if your team ain't worth a damn? That sort of thing. Jokic, best player in the game, and I'm not taking anything away from him. There's no but to this. It was just that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, the gap was so wide. It's a 19-game gap between Team A and Team B. And then you saw in Game 7, the gap between Team A and Team B, you know, being so pronounced between Oklahoma City and Denver, I won't say felt validated, but it feels like this is a worthy sort of MVP thing. My final thing to you, because I didn't think about this earlier, do you think Ant relishes the opportunity? Oh, Shai's winning the MVP. Let me see if I can take him down. Do you think that sits with him?
Yes. 100% yes. Yes. Absolutely. Because I think Ant views Shai, as a member of his peer group. Like they're three years apart in age, but this is look somebody who's probably gonna be in each other's way for the next half decade to decade, right? So I think that this could be the start of a bit of a rivalry here. I think it's different when Ant wants smoke from everybody, right? And is in LeBron, KD, guys he looked up to, Steph, it doesn't matter. So especially from Shai too, yes, absolutely. But I think it's different too, but like LeBron, KD, everybody's got rings, they're legends, I think there's a different level of, just respect and stuff like that when guys have that resume. Shai's trying to build the same resume now that Ant is trying to build.
Right.
So I think there's a little different edge, not to say that like it's personal or, because Ant has said that he thought Shai was the MVP at various times this season.
That's right.
So I don't think it's personal.
I feel like he said Shai should have won it last year.
It's competitive.
I feel like he said, Shea should have won it last year or something like that.
I think, I think he might have, but then at various times when Jokic put up 60 on them in Denver a couple weeks back, I think Ant said Jokic should have been the MVP after that game, which, listen, if somebody just put up 60 on you, you know, that's, yeah. So I think at various times Ant has said both should have been the MVP.
Right.
But that's, like I said, not that it's personal, but it's competitive, and that's what we like, right? We want to see guys that want to take each other down, right? That's what we live for. Yeah, absolutely.
I say all the time, Ant has bad kid energy. And I say that in the most affectionate way. I don't mean bad kid energy like, man, he gonna wind up shooting up the joint. No, I mean like bad kid, like, man, he's so bad, but everybody loves him. Like that sort of thing. So yeah, Shea's the MVP. Yeah, I'm gonna take his ass down. Like that is the stuff that we love. And I feel like hopefully, even though we're in this age of parity, hopefully we will be able to see some form of Shea, Luka, Ant, Cooper Flagg, whoever, battling for this invisible crown, you know, for the next decade, half decade or whatever. But Chris Hine, really appreciate you, man, for joining us. Put that book up one more time and give us the date and everything else.
June 3rd, everywhere. Pre-orders available, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you name it, your local bookstores. You know, very fortunate and kind of surreal that this is happening. So, you know, would be great for people to read Ant's story, because I think you're going to enjoy it and learn a lot about him in the process.
I'm learning a lot and I'm only a couple chapters in. So, man, really, really appreciate you. Thanks, Chris. Really appreciate you. Thanks to Dakota and the entire team behind the scenes who helps us put together this show. I'll be back in a couple of days for the next episode of The Good Word. Until then, everybody be safe.